Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. With neither side willing to negotiate, is the Ukraine war becoming a forever war? Let's get to the bottom line. After 10 months of fighting, the Ukraine war has settled into a scary cycle. Any Ukrainian advance on Russian forces in the east is almost immediately followed by Russian drone strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure in the west. So besides the death and the destruction and displacement of people, folks are also suffering in freezing temperatures with no electricity. Ukraine insists that the war is not over until the very last Russian soldier leaves its territory. Moscow can afford to wait it out because the fighting isn't on its soil and Western sanctions haven't crippled the economy. Sure, the conflict is coming home for Russians as they hear horror stories from their own young, mobilized, mostly male population on the front lines, but the war machine just rages on. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden has been able to spend an average of $7 billion per month on the Ukraine war. But now that the Republicans control Congress, can he keep up the pace next year? Or will Ukraine soon have to make tough compromises and sit down at the negotiating table? Today, we're taking a look at the next phase of the war with Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard University and author of The Hell of Good Intentions, American Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Steve, it's so great to be with you again. This is always a tough discussion, I want to tell people. None of us take what's going on lightly, but I'm very happy to be talking to Dr. Walt today about what history tells us at moments like this. What should we be thinking about that maybe we're afraid to talk about where the Ukraine is, war is going, Steve?
Well, I think probably the scariest prospect for most of us is that you won't get the kind of decisive Hollywood ending that many people would like to see here. I think most of us would like to see where you get a sort of decisive, humiliating defeat of Russia. The United States and its allies can claim, a great foreign policy victory. The Ukrainians get all of their territory back, and Russia is chastened in the future by this. That's, I think, what many people would like to see. And the problem is that while that is, I guess, still a remote possibility, it's by no means the most likely possibility. I think the most likely possibility is that, you know, if we have this conversation a year from now, Russia is still controlling a substantial amount of Ukrainian territory. Vladimir Putin is still in power in Moscow, and Ukraine has suffered another year's worth of damage. That's not going to look like such a happy story. But it's precisely in situations like that that each side has to start rethinking what its war aims are and start asking whether there is some sort of political compromise that neither one is necessarily going to like very much, but it's better than allowing the war to continue forever.
Well, President Biden has been very hesitant to ask Ukraine to begin any sort of real negotiations process, but both around the president, but also very top-tier national security voices are beginning to say we need another track. One of them is Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger in The Spectator wrote, "The time is approaching to build on the strategic changes which have already been accomplished and to integrate them into a new structure towards achieving peace through negotiation." A representative of President Vladimir Zelensky was very quick to respond. He says, "All supporters of simple solutions should remember the obvious. Any agreement with the devil, a bad peace at the expense of Ukrainian territories, will be a victory for Putin and a recipe for success for autocrats around the world." And that was Ukrainian presidential aide Mykhailo Podolyak. Well, I think that frames pretty well, you know, two dimensions in the debate. And I guess one of the questions I have for you, Stephen, is America and NATO so wrapped up in this process now that we can't be the party that begins talking about how to seek a compromise or negotiate? Are we still stuck on one side of this that we're no longer able to see the other side?
I don't think that's quite true. It's true that the United States may not be the best honest broker here, given that we're all in on one particular side. And there may have to be third parties that help sort of smooth the beginnings of this discussion. I might add that the aide to President Zelensky is right. This is not going to be an easy negotiation by any means. And the obstacles to any kind of political settlement are formidable. I mean, people who talk about, going to peace talks and reaching a solution solution very quickly, I think have not thought through clearly just how difficult this is going to be. Ukraine has every reason to want some kind of assurances that this isn't going to happen again. Russia will undoubtedly have its own desires for certain assurances so that the things that helped lead it to start the war in the first place are alleviated. And none of these are going to be easy to work out at all. So I wouldn't be naive about it. But nonetheless, the thing that's going to drive, I think, consideration of some form of negotiated settlement is the difficulty that both sides are going to have in achieving any kind of decisive breakthrough on the ground. It's quite clear that the initial Russian war plan was badly designed. Their forces mismanaged it. They weren't prepared. They made miscalculation after miscalculation. But at this point, their war effort does appear to be improving slightly. They have defensible positions that are going to be hard for the Ukrainians to tackle. It's going to be increasingly hard for either side, I think, to make really decisive gains. And yet the pain will continue. And it's at points like that, what sometimes is called a hurting stalemate, that then you get people to say, well, okay, we're not going to get everything we might want, but what can we get that we might be able to live with? I don't think we're there yet, by the way. But that's, I think, where this is ultimately going to end up.
You know, one of the questions I have is how much pain are the Russians feeling from this? And recently, I met with a gentleman who was the former chief of staff of the German Defense Ministry. He's now working for the Munich Security Conference. And he's very adamant that Ukraine will win and will prevail in this. He said that the Russian soldiers are untrained, unprepared. They are, while we're seeing pictures of Ukrainians, you know, freezing in these terrible temperatures because of hit infrastructure, he said the moment Russian soldiers get wet or their uniforms aren't managed properly, they will freeze in these temperatures because they're untrained to know what to do. And I'm just interested at some certain levels at whether the feedback coming back into Russia with the mobilization of so many of its young men and the battlefield scenes on the Russian side, which are pretty horrific, whether or not, from your experience, that matters in a place like Russia, that even if it's not a democracy in the way you and I look at it, a lot of Russians still think they are a democracy.
Right. There's no question that, you know, the Russian soldiers have suffered enormously and were not particularly well prepared for this. Again, there are some indications that they're getting their act together to some degree. One of the things that's very frustrating in trying to figure out where we are in this particular conflict is that it's hard to know what the relative balance is on either side. I think we tend to get more upbeat reports from what's happening on the Ukrainian side. It's hard to get numbers on exactly what Ukrainian losses have been. We hear a lot about how badly the Russians are suffering. We don't hear as much about what's happening on the Ukrainian side, apart from the civilian suffering that Ukraine is going through. And that makes it really hard to know exactly what the balance of forces is likely to be. It's also just worth remembering, Russia's got three times the population. Putin's mobilization has brought 300,000 more soldiers into the meat grinder. How well prepared they're going to be, how well they'll be able to fight, remains to be seen, it seems to me. But again, the Russians at this point are fighting on the defensive, and they have devoted an enormous amount of effort over the last few months to building defensive positions in some key areas. Whether that will be enough, again, we don't know yet. It would be, in some respects, what all of us hope for is if that turns out not to be effective. What I don't think any of this is going to do, though, is cause a fundamental rethinking in Moscow anytime soon. You're not going to see, it seems to me, a popular uprising. I think the combination of Russian propaganda and the security forces around Putin are going to be able to keep the lid on this. So even though it's not particularly popular, even though the conduct of the war gets lots of criticism in the Russian blogosphere as well and on email and things like that, I don't think that's going to lead to the kind of political change in Russia that will cause an immediate, as I said, Hollywood ending to this particular conflict. And I take no pleasure whatsoever in saying that.
Let me put up some figures of what U.S. aid to Ukraine is amounting to be. In 2022 alone, we have contributed about $68 billion President Biden has now requested an additional $37.7 billion, and that would bring the total, if approved, up to about $105 billion. It's running about $7 billion a month to support Ukraine. And as we said, Congress is going to be have a new dimension here shortly in a couple of weeks, and the Republicans will be controlling it. Now, to be clear to our friends, Republicans are not anti-supporting Ukraine. Some Republicans are, some Democrats are, but this may become more of an issue about whether or not there is a blank check to supporting Ukraine. And I'm wondering whether you see where you see that going in terms of pressure. You've advocated that maybe we need another course, maybe we need to find a way towards a negotiated outcome of this, given the realities. But does that pressure on the financial side help?
Well, I don't think you're going to see a congressionally mandated cutoff anytime soon. I think the Congress will give the Biden administration what it wants, at least for the next few months. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. I do worry about the fact that even with the best will in the world, it may be somewhat more difficult for the West, to include the United States, to provide the levels of support that they've been able to sustain up until now. And that's in part because we've simply drawn down a lot of our own ammunition stocks to provide it to the Ukrainians. So even if we want to keep supporting them at the level we have, that may be hard to do. It's sort of the military equivalent of a supply chain problem. But the thing that I think worries me the most is that we still don't have a completely effective counter and may never get one to the attacks the Russians have been making on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure, and especially its power grid. That kind of damage, if it eventually were to bring down the Ukrainian power grid, is a true catastrophe. And again, it's not just undermining Ukrainian morale. At that point, you really have a situation where, you know, millions of Ukrainians might end up having to flee the country, which is already an issue for them. So there are things that could happen in the next few months. Again, I hope they do not, which worry me greatly and are somewhat independent of, you know, the billions of dollars up or down that the United States is able to provide.
You know, both your article that appeared recently in Foreign Policy magazine, I highly recommend it to people, it's called The Perpetually Irrational Ukraine Debate, but also Henry Kissinger's article in The Spectator, both out very recently, kind of raised this broad issue that where we're going right now isn't going to work. And to Kissinger's point, he said in World War I, which was a fight about a lot of things, a fight about morality, a fight about, you know, alliances, essentially the United States at that moment in World War I eventually became someone who could come in from the side and begin trying to do something different. Is there anywhere, you're famous in Arab-Israeli talks, is there an Oslo out there? You can't use Oslo anymore because they're now in NATO, I guess. But, I mean, is there a force out there that could come by way and begin becoming part of the scene, set the table, set the dinner, bring the parties together, and begin talking about potential alternative outcomes?
I don't think so. When the war initially broke out, I thought that the country that might be able to perform a role like that was actually China, that it had influence with Russia. It had a reasonably good standing with the Ukrainians. It wasn't actively involved in the fight, and that Xi Jinping could represent himself as an independent mediator just trying to bring peace and score some great diplomatic points if he were able to pull that off. I think the Chinese response, which has been to sort of tacitly lean in support of the Russians, has now removed them from that role, and they're not really interested in playing this. I don't think there is a third party now that can essentially come in, grab each side by the scruff of the neck and say, okay, you're going to make a deal. It's too politically fraught for the Biden administration to try and play that role. I don't think Turkey, although it's played a mediating role on some minor issues connected with the conflict, but it's not in a position, doesn't have the leverage to produce the kind of deal. And ultimately, this will come down to the two sides deciding that they are better off reaching some kind of an agreement. I don't know what form that agreement would take. And that will, as I said earlier, involve an awful lot of complex bargaining over where lines are going to be drawn, the repatriation of prisoners, reconstruction aid for Ukraine, the whole issue of Ukrainian neutrality, which is one of the reasons the war started, assurances from the Russian side that they're not simply going to rearm and start this up again a few years down the road, et cetera. There's an enormous number of issues that would have to be thrashed out here. And perhaps the best one could hope for is a genuine armistice that, you know, doesn't necessarily end the quote-unquote conflict, but puts each side in a position where they don't want to resume things. A number of people, I think Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times, have recently raised the Korea example. There's still no peace treaty ending the Korean War, fought for 3 years from 1950 to 1953, but we have had an armistice that has held ever since then. And something like that, but fashioned appropriately for the specific circumstances of Ukraine, might be where we end up here.
Well, of course, the Korean War in part depends upon the trigger of U.S. soldiers deployed there, in part, including, you know, the likelihood of a nuclear potential, you know, option would come there. So that's a sort of scary scenario to begin thinking about. But I think on another side of it, I've been trying to ask myself, you know, for the United States and NATO. And I've been around a lot of officials recently who are just absolutely adamant that Russia cannot be given another permission slip, as some people said it was given after the invasion and annexation of Crimea, that its expansion activities are one, you know, and troubling in parts of Eastern Europe was something that needed a signal back. Otherwise, if you don't respond, then this problem will become a larger one. Do you think there's logic in that argument?
I understand the logic, but I'm not persuaded by it. The idea is that if somehow Russia gets anything out of this, you know, even permanent control of Crimea, that we've somehow rewarded aggression. We've somehow given them a free pass. And I think if you look at the damage that's been done to Russia and been done to the Russian military, it's quite clear that this is a strategic defeat for Russia, even if they extract some kind of Pyrrhic victory in some kind of final settlement. I mean, if you just consider what this has done to the Russian economy, what it's done to the Russian military, what it's done to Russia's global reputation, Europe permanently weaning itself off of Russia oil and gas, Russia being largely cut off from the most sophisticated forms of Western technology or forced to smuggle them in. This is going to have long-term negative consequences for Russia. In other words, they're paying an enormous price for the decision that Vladimir Putin made. So even if they were to extract some set of concessions at the end, preserve some control of Crimea or other parts of what was originally Ukrainian territory. Again, not something I would like to see happen, but if that were to happen, they have paid an enormous price for it, and I don't think Putin would be eager at any point in what's left of his life to replay this kind of experiment again somewhere else. The international community has, in fact, taught the lesson that aggression really does get penalized, and it really doesn't pay. Even if, again, there's some kind of compromise deal that ends the war.
Now, you and I have discussed China before, and China as a much more serious geostrategic challenge to the United States and allies. What do you think China is learning from this lesson? Are they seeing an America and a NATO that are willing to engage more deeply than they had? Or are they seeing us trapped in a strategic, you know, pit that we can't extract ourselves from?
Well, I'm sure there are a range of Chinese interpretations of what's going on here, but I think there are several lessons they ought to be drawing. One is that even sophisticated or well-prepared militaries sometimes screw up. And in fact, elaborate military plans don't always go the way you expect them to. So that suggests a conventional military assault on Taiwan, which would be difficult in the best of circumstances, is something they ought to really not consider, or at least not assume would go smoothly. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is the one you alluded to, that in fact, the international community tends to respond very vigorously to acts of unprovoked aggression. And a Chinese assault on Taiwan would be seen in that light. So the assumption that there would be disarray, that America's Asian partners would, not know how to respond, the idea that NATO would not react, perhaps even in an Asian context, all of those things are are things that I think the Chinese would not, you know, should take. These are the lessons the Chinese should observe from this. There was more life left in the Western alliance than they may have believed. However, the third part of this is that the longer this war goes on, the better it probably is for China. It's a huge distraction. It takes enormous amount of bandwidth. It is consuming American resources and Western resources that could be used for other purposes. So in a Chinese context, in some, and one final thing, it's making Russia more dependent upon China and ultimately a more compliant ally. So if you are looking for a grand strategic imperative to try and bring the war to an end sooner rather than later, it's also so that the United States can focus on what is the longer geostrategic challenge, which is China, not Russia.
You know, recently, Steve, I interviewed the incoming chair of the House Commerce and Energy Committee, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, and I asked her about where her support for Ukraine was and how much were her own constituents willing to tolerate high prices, shortages, et cetera, down the road potentially related to the crisis. And her response was, you know, my people really don't want to see prices continue to go up. Inflation is really hurting them. And she's still, of course, sympathetic and empathetic on the Ukraine front, but it raises the interesting question of what the future is going to look like. We're seeing, you know, a global food security crisis. We're seeing energy weaponized. We're seeing authoritarianism, populism, et cetera, in reaction to some of these. How messy a year or a couple of years do you see ahead as a result of a crisis like this one?
Yeah. There's been some good news on the inflation front, at least here in the United States, less so in other parts of the world. So that's something we may hope, you know, continues. But I think you've put your finger on what is a real problem now if we do end up with a stalemate in Ukraine. And that is, it's one thing to get people in other countries to make sacrifices in the short term if they think those sacrifices are going to pay off. It's much harder to get people to continue to make the same sacrifices when it appears to be kind of open-ended, that this is not ultimately going to get resolved anytime soon. Are we going to have to do this for years, 2, 3 years, 4 years? I mean, you and I saw this same problem with the so-called forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Even when there's public support initially for them, if you don't have the prospect of success down the road, it's much harder to get people to continue to pony up. And then it makes it even worse, of course, if conditions at home become more difficult. I think this is something actually the Ukrainian government is well aware of, which is one of the reasons they have been trying to tout, you know, recent military successes, and I think are hoping for more, because the more they can demonstrate that, you know, momentum is on their side and this isn't going to take forever, the more likely Western support is to be sustained. The difficulty is, I think the military challenge for them is actually going to get harder, not easier in the future. And then the domestic considerations that you just raised are going to kick in more powerfully.
Well, Stephen Walt, Harvard University Professor of International Relations, thank you for your candor. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Great talking with you as always, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? Ending the war in Ukraine is a tough decision for the Western allies. They feel that they didn't do enough in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea, and that kind of gave Russian President Vladimir Putin a permission slip, in my view, to try to roll over the rest of the country. Now the U.S. and the other NATO nations have made Ukraine, which was not an ally, and that has to be noted, the defining challenge for themselves. That means their own self-image and their own sense of security is also wrapped up in the fate of Ukraine. But how long will Americans accept to pump money and weapons into this cause? If it becomes a forever war, American and European support is bound to wither. So what should Ukraine do? It's damned if it compromises and damned if it doesn't. And both options have very tragic consequences. So as we head into a new year, we have nothing to look forward to but a slow slog of back and forth victories and tragedies in freezing temperatures. Sadly, this war seems nowhere near to an end, and that's the bottom line.